Now, I will give you the data.
Nature.
Go on.
He who does what he likes is not happy if his desires exceed his strength. It is so with a child in like conditions. Even in the state of nature, children only enjoy an imperfect liberty, like that enjoyed by men in social life. Each of us, unable to dispense with the help of others, becomes so far weak and wretched. We were meant to be men. Laws and customs thrust us back into infancy.
Yeah, let's stop here. So you see, on the one hand, Rousseau of course admits that children are imperfect. To that extent, he admits it. But as I say, he tries to qualify it as much as possible. And the second point is, in this quotation as well as in the preceding one, which we have seen before, the state of society is a state incompatible with happiness. A citizen cannot be happy except in a spurious way, that Rousseau repeats again. Now let us read the next paragraph.
These are weighty considerations, and they provide a solution for all the conflicting problems of our
society. For all contradictions of the social system. So in other words, the contradictions are essential to the social system. And therefore, if Rousseau's teaching is self-contradictory, he is entitled to say he only reproduces the contradiction inherent in the social system. This is not a self-contradiction, a true self-contradiction. And secondly, but there is a solution. And what is that? What is that solution? That is page 49, paragraph 3.
There are two kinds of dependence. Dependence on things, which is the work of nature, and dependence on men, which is the work of society. Dependence on things, being non-moral, does no injury to liberty and begets no vices. Dependence on men, being out of order, gives rise to every kind of vice. And through this, master and slave become mutually depraved. If there is any cure for this social evil, it is to be found in the substitution of law for the individual, in arming the general will with a real strength beyond the power of any individual will. If the laws of nations, like the laws of nature...
The laws of nations means, of course, positive human laws, not international law. Yeah? Yeah.
Like the laws of nature, could never be broken by any human power, dependence in men would become dependence in things. All the advantages of the state of nature would be combined with all the advantages of social life in the commonwealth. The liberty which preserves a man from vice would be united with a morality which raises him to virtue.
Yeah, so you see, that is a very interesting point, because at the beginning, Rousseau simply said, no solution of the contradiction is possible, either man or citizen. Do you remember that? Now here he begins at least to play with the notion of a possible solution. Yeah? And he indicates it. Now, the formula which he uses here are fundamentally the formula of the social contract, and which we will take up later. So we can therefore say the well-constructed civil society brings about the closest approximation of the citizen to the man in a democracy. Man lives in a way as natural as if he did not live in society, subject to laws. That is, now this, of course, in this strict sense cannot be achieved, as will be made clear. He surely states again the principle of education, of what he regards as sound education. No subjection of man to men. Dependence on things is inevitable. I mean, we need food, we need shelter. But dependence of man on man must be avoided Since it cannot be avoided completely, it must mean mutual dependence. If I depend on X as much as X depends on me, I am not simply dependent. So under the condition of equality, of social political equality, the dependence of man on man would be as small as it can be. Now, it follows also, we cannot possibly read everything, it follows also that a child must be taught to bear sufferings, bodily pains, because otherwise he would be as grown up being all the time. And there also it's rather tough. You know, no spoiling of children regarding heat and cold, hunger and thirst and so on. You do not have to read that. Now let us turn to page 53, paragraph 2-3, I believe it is.
The very words obey and command.
Now let me once see. No, that cannot be. No, can you give me the translation for one moment?
Looted by runaway slave Sahiris, as I meant to have told you if some other matter had not come in the way. On my return, when after supper we were about to retire to rest, my brother said to me, Protagoras has arrived. I was going to you at once, and then I thought that the night was far spent. But the moment sleep left me after my fatigue, I got up and came straight here.
Yeah, so we know now why he was so delicate. He explains, one could almost say, he apologizes for not having come straight away in the evening. He also explains why he did not hear the news of Protagoras earlier. He was busy pursuing a runaway slave. He forgets to say whether he brought him back. That's anybody's guess. I would bet that he brought him back. He takes it for granted that Socrates is eagerly concerned with all his movements. Yeah? I forgot to tell you that my slave was run away. You know, as if Socrates was particularly eager. In other words, he's quite egocentric, as they say. Oinoi, there were more than one, may be the place of that name near the Boeotian border, which is about 50 miles away from Athens. He might have heard of Protagoras' arrival at once, but for his going after the fugitive slave. These two things seem to be incompatible somehow. The intellectual pursuit and the pursuit of the slave. He came back hungry, and only after the meal did the brother tell him, because as you can see, this young fellow with his animal spirits, if he is hungry, no intellect. First, a solid meal. Perhaps also his brother was not so excited about Protagoras as Hippocrates is, you know, and mentioned among the many other news from town after they had spoken about the runaway slave and all everything connected with that. Yes?
I, who knew the eagerness and excitement of the man, said...
Yeah, no, let us stop it. Here Socrates characterizes Hippocrates. And I, knowing his manliness, and his vehemence, the proteuses is derived from a verb which means to terrify, to scare, to excite. So it is not mere excitement, it has also the meaning of a tougher meaning, you know, terrifying. So he's, and he has shown this clearly by his running after the runaway slave. You know, this was, he's not a gentle master. He knows what belongs to him. Yes? Now begin again with the sentence.
I, who knew the courage and vehemence of the man, said, to you, is that to you? Has Protagoras robbed you of something?
Yeah, literally, does Protagoras by any means wrong you? Now, a manly individual like Porus is likely to be excited if someone wronged him. Now, if he is excited about the arrival of Protagoras, it is likely that Protagoras wronged him just as his slave had wronged him. Yeah? It's perfectly natural. Yes?
He replied, laughing, "Yes, indeed, he has, Socrates, of the wisdom which he keeps from me."
Yeah, he says, by the gods. That is the second time he uses his very comprehensive sermon, by the gods. And he says it laughingly. Now, laughing is something which Socrates never does, or hardly ever, but which is also in the Republic, for example, Adeimantos never laughs, Glaucon laughs, old Cephalos laughs. This is, one can make a collection of that, it's worthwhile. And one can say it generally is a sign of animal spirits, yeah, to laugh. I mean, smiling is something different, laughing loud. And since animal spirits, Hippolytus obviously has, he does not for one moment consider that Socrates might be wise or make other people wise. That's clear, I mean, that appears from this very question. The only man to make me wise is Protagoras, which implies he doesn't expect anything of this nature from Socrates. Yes?
But surely, I said.
No, by Zeus, they should translate this more literally. Yeah?
By Zeus, I said, if you give him money and talk him into it, he will make you wise too.
Brilliant. The difficulty Socrates says to him can be overcome if you pay money to Protagoras. Of course, you must also persuade him. Yeah? You must also persuade him, which seems to imply that, but Protagoras doesn't take on everybody who brings him money, but is somewhat selective. Here occurs Socrates' first oath, which is much less comprehensive than the oath used by Hippocrates. He swears only by Zeus. And in the sequel, you will see, immediate sequel, Hippocrates also swears only by Zeus, so he, in a way, he is influenced by Socrates. Yes. The oaths in the Hippocrates section, in this very short section, are more numerous than all the oaths in the rest of the dialogue, which is a fact which I give you first also as a brute fact, empirically, and whether we can draw any conclusion from that is another matter. I believe we can, but I believe we must make some progress first. Yes?
By Zeus, he replied, that it depended on that. He might take all that I have and all that my friends have, if he pleased.
No, I made a mistake regarding the oath. He says now, O Zeus and the gods. I mean, he makes, after Socrates has emphasized Zeus, he makes now a distinction between Zeus and the other gods, whereas for it, previously he had used the sweeping formula. Yes, go on. I'm sorry, yeah?
That it depended on him. He might take all that I have and all that my friends have, if he pleased. But that is why I have come to you now, in order that you may speak to him on my behalf, for I am young, and also I have never seen nor heard him when he visited Athens before I was but a child. And all men praise him, Socrates. He is reputed to be the most accomplished of speakers. There is no reason why we should not go to him at once, so that we shall find him at home. He lodges, as I hear, with Callias, the son of Hipponicus. Let's go.
Yeah, so Hippocrates makes clear to Socrates that it is not a matter of money only. Protagoras must also be persuaded, obviously, because he knows Protagoras doesn't accept everyone. And Hippocrates takes it for hopes and takes it for granted that Socrates, not Hippocrates, can persuade Protagoras to take Hippocrates on as a pupil. That is a function of Socrates in his eyes. The wisdom which Hippocrates admires, the wisdom of speaking. Yeah? Protagoras is very clever in speaking. From his point of view, from Hippocrates' point of view, there is no difference between rhetoric and sophistry. As we have seen from the Gorgias, where the remark is made, they are very identical, at least very close to each other. Now, the so-called historical Hippocrates, I mean, distinguishing Hippocrates as a character in this play, it was the one who raised the claim that he can make the weaker speech the stronger. The phrase stems from Protagoras, which is, of course, a part of rhetoric, you know. I mean, One thing we have already seen from this beginning, Socrates talks to Protagoras on behalf of Hippocrates. This we let us keep in mind. And let us now read the sequel.
I replied, "Not yet, my good friend, the hour is too early. But let us rise and take a turn in the court, and wait about there until daybreak. When the day breaks, then we will go. For Protagoras is usually at home, and we shall be sure to find him in, never fear."
Yeah, that is, the emphasis is somewhat, Protagoras stays most of the time inside, so that we will catch him, quite naturally, inside, indoors. Socrates does not prevent Hippocrates from seeing Protagoras, but he silently teaches him somewhat better manners. Well, it's too early, you know. Socrates knows Protagoras' habits, which means he knows Protagoras. At the beginning, here he says, "Let us not yet go there, thither." Ekaise in Greek, which is very commonly used also in the sense in opposition to hither, meaning in this life, and in that life, to Hades. We will see later on that this is a reasonable explanation of this fact. And you see the emphasis on indoors by the repetition. Protagoras is not the outdoor type, to which Hippocrates rather would belong. I mean, you know, the pursuing his runaway slave, that's a great thing. And Protagoras is more of one of these womanish men who sit indoors and talk the whole day. Yes? So this much has been, Socrates says, yes, I will introduce you to Protagoras, but not now. It's too early. And then he uses the time which he gained this way for warning Hippocrates of the danger to which he exposed himself by becoming a pupil of Protagoras. And now let us read that.
"Upon this we got up and walked about in the court, and I thought that I would test the strength of his resolution. So I examined him and put questions to him."
Now let us stop. This is quite a little thing which we must keep in mind. Socrates tells us in the sequel the questions which he put to him and the answers which Hippocrates gave him. But if this were now a performed or dramatic dialogue, how would this look? Socrates, you would hear Socrates' question, Hippocrates' answer. What would you not hear?
Socrates' intention.
Exactly. Why he poses this question? He says he wanted to test the strength of Hippocrates. This is a great virtue of the narrated dialogue. That in a narrated dialogue you can say things which cannot be said in a performed dialogue. Socrates tells us, in quotation marks, what he could not have said to the interlocutor. This is from that point of view, the great virtue of the narrative dialogue. Yes?
Now, what does he ask him?
Tell me, Hippocrates, I said, as you were going to Protagoras and will be paying your money to him, what is he to whom you are going, and what will he make of you? If, for example, you had thought to going to Hippocrates of Cos, the Asclepiad, and were about to give him your money, and someone had said to you, you are paying money to your namesake, Hippocrates, O Hippocrates, tell me, what is he that you give him money? How would you have answered? I should say, he replied, that I gave money to him as a physician. And what will he make of you? A physician, he said. And if you were resolved to go to Polycletus the Argive, or Phidias the Athenian, and were intending to give them money, and someone had asked you, what are Polycletus and Phidias, and why do you propose to give them this money? How would you have answered? I should have answered that they were sculptors. And what will they make of you? A sculptor, of course.
Now let us stop here. Here we have an interesting parallel to this story in the Gorgias in 447d, where Socrates says to Xenophon, Xenophon asks him, in the Gorgias, Xenophon says, what should I ask? Socrates, what he is? How do you mean? Well, if he happened to be a maker of shoes, he would of course reply that he is a shoemaker. Or do you not understand what I mean? I understand, and I will ask him. Tell me, Gorgias, and so on. Then he knows. In other words, in the case of Xenophon, only one line is necessary to explain to him what he does. Here in the case of Hippocrates, a very long explanation is needed. Now this is, I believe, the first case we have in this dialogue of a dialogue within the dialogue. You know that Socrates causes the illusion that someone else asks Hippocrates, if someone would ask you, and what would you reply to him? So it is not so, you see, Socrates not only does not tell Hippocrates that he is testing him, he also has the additional courtesy not to ask him questions. A third individual, non-existent, created for the purpose by Socrates, asks the questions. Is this clear? I mean, if he is embarrassed by the questions, he will not be embarrassed by Socrates, by this invisible, non-existent third. Is this point clear? That this is a great advantage which this has? Yes. Good. Now, the examples which he takes are medicine and sculpture, as you have seen. And these are high arts, highly respected arts. It is not absurd to think that someone like Hippocrates might wish to become a physician or a sculptor. Now, there are three such artisans mentioned. Hippocrates from Cos, Polycletus from Argos, and Phidias from Athens. In all cases, the town where the men came from, or where they live, is added. Why does he do it? Because, after all, in the first case, it has a very simple reason. Hippocrates, after all, this fellow himself is called Hippocrates. Which Hippocrates are you speaking of? So he could be identified only by mentioning the hometown. But this was probably not necessary in the two other cases of Polycletus and of Phidias. Why does he do that? I would say, in case of this kind, whether these men are strangers or citizens is not very important. Yeah? I mean, if they know who they are very well. Consider, if we generalize from that, there might be, Protagoras of course is a stranger, we must never forget that. There might also be an Athenian who might make Hippocrates wise. or wiser at any rate than he is. This notion never occurs to Hippocrates. In other words, he does not expect to learn anything of any importance from Socrates. That is perfectly clear throughout. In a parallel in the Gorgias, in 484b, the examples are medicine and painting. Now, they are obviously very close, medicine being the same and painting very close to sculpture. The medicine deals with the human body, and painting and sculpture imitate the human body, but in different ways. Two-dimensionally and three-dimensionally, that makes quite a difference between the two things, not to go into another point. Now, is there any other thing which strikes you here in this hitherto, Mr. Rankin?
Yeah, but you might have other reasons for giving money to a physician and even to a sculptor. And in the first case, it struck me stronger that it might be a nobler, a more suitable concern in going to a physician to be made well. And he's going to Protagoras. He wants to go to Protagoras to acquire a craft, namely speech. Protagoras is effective speaking, he admires. He wants to be like Protagoras. He doesn't really want to be made wise, just as he doesn't want to go to a physician to be made well.
Yeah, but still, if you go, I see. Yeah, but is this necessary to insert here? I mean, he wants to become wise, i.e. to become a good speaker. And therefore he goes to he wants to learn. And therefore he considers only the case of your going to a physician in order to learn from the physician, not in order to be treated. Yeah? Is this not the situation? Mr. Schultz?
Would you say that when, in the case of his being made wise by Socrates, though, it would be more a case of his being treated than of his becoming like Socrates?
I see. In other words, I see that you would link this up with this point that he does not even imagine that he could be helped by Socrates in this.
That he doesn't imagine that what he needs isn't, it isn't as if he were to go to a doctor to become a doctor, but what he really needs is to be able to go to some wise person to be treated rather than to be taught.
Yeah, this is fundamental for Mr. Rankin. Yeah. Yes, Mr. Levy?
He mentioned the town with every name but Protagoras. He mentioned Protagoras' town in the first dialogue, in the first form of the dialogue, Abdera. Is it possible, one thing, that these towns have reputations to them? Like we say, in the Indian land, say, stupid as a Sikh. Is it possible, I think I heard some Daywrights, people from Abdera,
yeah, it is by no means sure that Abdera had already this reputation at that time. That's the reason why I disregard it. Later on, yes, it was famous, but not yet there. At that time, it was best known, I think, as a hometown of Democritus, where, you know, the philosopher. Yes?
One other question. In the Gorgias, you mentioned that polis is the Greek word for cult. Does Protagoras have a Greek meaning?
Yeah, but I can tell you that, but it comes out very simply, but it comes out much more beautifully when we come to his speech later on. I mean, I think jokes must be always be told at the proper place. Yeah, good. Yes?
I wonder the fact that Socrates volunteers the names of the towns to which these artists belong, but he has to be asked the town from which Protagoras comes, which also shows something about the difference between Protagoras and his art and these other people in their art.
No, this was different. The name of the new, of course, Protagoras. That wasn't the first conversation with the comrade. And he, Socrates says first he comes from Abdera. He has mentioned Protagoras. If he had just spoken of Protagoras, it would not have been necessary to mention that he comes from Abdera.
But he has to be asked. We're in the stage.
You know, in other words, when he says this beautiful being comes from Abdera, they do not for one moment think that this is old Protagoras. Because they do not connect beauty and wisdom. I do not know a convenient present-day example. Yes.
This is just a small one in this section right before that. When Socrates said he was going to test Hippocrates.
His strength. Yeah, firmness. Yeah.
But doesn't that imply bodily strength?
Yeah, primarily it would be strength, justice in English, but here at this point, in this connection, it obviously needs the firmness of purpose. Would he truly insist on going to Protagoras after he has been treated by Socrates? That is the point. Good. Now, let us see. Where do we go here? These examples of the physician and the sculptor are only examples for bringing out the radical difference between these respectable arts, medicine and sculpture, and the art of sophistry. And therefore that comes out in the secret. Yeah?
Well now, I said, you and I are going to Protagoras, and we are ready to pay him money as a fee on your behalf. If our own means are sufficient, and we can gain him with these, we shall be only too glad. But if not, then we are to spend the money of your friends as well.
Well, of the friends, it can also mean of my friends, yeah, or of our friends.
Now suppose that...
This is the first warning shot. Hitherto it was perfectly clear. These examples were uninteresting fundamentally because Hippocrates doesn't dream of becoming a physician or of becoming a sculptor. But now it becomes serious. We go there and pay money. Yeah, and not only a little bit, but perhaps we ruin ourselves and our friends together. And so it must be truly worthwhile, yes?
Here he says here that if we persuade him with the money, the persuasion here would be with the money. The other part is wrapped out, whether we can...
In Greek the word to bribing is called persuading with money, which is a perfectly intelligible expression. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Now suppose that, while we are thus enthusiastically pursuing our object, someone were to say to us, tell me, Socrates, and you, Hippocrates, what is Protagoras, and why do you propose to pay him money? How should we answer? I know that Phidias is a sculptor and that Homer is a poet, but what appellation is given to Protagoras? How is he designated? They call him a sophist, Socrates, he replied.
Him, the man, in the sense of hombre. Because he's really an outstanding personality. Yes, they call him a sort. Yes. Next.
Then we are going to pay our money to him in the character of a sophist. Certainly.
Yeah, now Socrates and Hippocrates go together and pay together. That's clear. And they are asked questions together. But this is all for Hippocrates' sake. There is this great difference between the two, although they do everything else together. To study with Protagoras is obviously very expensive, and the seriousness of purpose is measured by the amount of money you are willing to invest. I think this has not changed since. He drops now the physician, as you have seen, and adds the poet, which is also already an indication that Protagoras' art is somehow not like that of the physician, but an imitative art, as these other arts mentioned were. Yes. Now, yeah, Mr. Hewitt.
Is there any other name that Hippocrates could have given
Protagoras at this point. And could even call him a wise man, a teacher, or a philosopher? Or
yeah, but then is a question, but he surely knew quite well in these circles Protagoras would be called. Whether what a sophist is another matter. You know, we have a beautiful present day parallel, intellectual. What is an intellectual? You know, I will take this up. We are compelled to take it up by the text. And maybe let us only stop here for the time being. So, now I think we should read a little bit on, two more pages, yeah. Now, you know, first he asks him, how would you call him, as you would know the answer in the case of the physician and sculptor, sophist. Now, if he would now ask you Hippocrates, no longer Socrates, in addition, yes?
Yeah. But suppose the person were to ask you this further question, and how about yourself? What will Protagoras make of you if you go to see him? He answered with a blush upon his face, but the day was just beginning to dawn so that I could see him. Unless this differs in some way from the former instances, I suppose that he will make a sophist of me.
Yeah, this is of course a great, that is enormous. So the difference between the question regarding the sophist and the questions regarding the physician and sculptor. Is the second half of the question, namely, what will become of you, is to be answered by Hippocrates alone. He has no longer the support. They also go together, they pay together, but here he is entirely on his own. And here he begins to see the difficulty. He blushes. He would be ashamed to become a sophist, like Callicles. Also, is delighted to learn the art of teaching, but it would be a shame to become a sophist. Whether Socrates would become ashamed or not, of course, we cannot draw any conclusion from that because of the tremendous ambiguity of the word sophist. Yes?
By the gods, I said, and would you not...
Now, here you see, here Socrates begins with the swearing in this scene. Yeah? Yes?
And would you not be ashamed to present yourself to the Hellenes in the character of a sophist? Indeed, Socrates, to confess the truth, I am.
Yeah, you know, he swears by Zeus also. By Zeus, if I should tell what I think. Yeah. Socrates swears now first, and of course, Hippocrates responds in kind. He, as it were, reminds Hippocrates of the gods, because there is some dubious relation between the sophists and the gods. Hippocrates was known to have said that he doesn't know where the gods are, the difficulty of the subject and the brevity of his life prevented from finding out. And he was also driven out, expelled from Athens because of his the alleged impiety. Socrates, however, that's important. Socrates suggests to Hippocrates that it is improper to be a sophist. Yeah. I mean, the suggestion falls on very fertile soil, that's the way it's suggested. Now, let us read the sequel.
But truly you mean, Hippocrates, that the instruction you will receive from Protagoras will not be of this nature, but rather that it will be like the instruction you have received when you got your elementary schooling, your lyre lessons, and your physical training. For you learned all that not in order to acquire a professional skill, which you would practice as a specialist, but to get an education that befits a layman and a freeman. Just so, he said. And that, in my opinion, is a far truer account of the teaching of Protagoras.
Let us stop here. Yeah, this is what Hippocrates says, yeah, the last sentence. Now, the context is this. A sophist is a low-class man. This is implied in Hippocrates' blush. Now, we have to consider that for one moment, because in itself that is just a social prejudice. Yeah, I mean, you know what kind of people, actors, and actresses were regarded former times as the scum of society, and today they occupy the highest places. And so these are prejudices dependent on time and place, which we cannot take too seriously, and which we cannot assume Socrates to have taken too seriously. Why are they so distrusted or disliked? Well, they are people who teach high things for money. That was the reason, the first reason. They are prostitutes. They prostitute the arts and so on. But if we are honest, we must say they do not do anything worse than professors do. George Grote, in the famous author of the History of Greece, made a strong point that this terrible things said against the sophists in the Plato are really unfair, and the worst things which they are accused of doing are things which every MP, and who could be more respectable in the eyes of George Grote than an MP, does. So, surely, here, now let us look a bit more closely. Socrates does not teach for money, that's clear, that's the difference. But he lives, as he says in the Apology, in 10,000-fold poverty. He would to say today in a millionaire's poverty. He has no visible means of support. But what is the economic basis of his life? After all, he must eat and drink, and he has children and a wife, and so. Now, this subject is discussed with the necessary delicacy in a dialogue properly entitled Economicus by Xenophon. I read to you only a short passage from this dialogue. I'm sorry, where is that? Well, say, what is property? What is wealth? That is the question. Now, wealth is the totality of useful things a man has. For example, wealth is that from which a man can derive profit or benefit. At any rate, if a man uses his money to buy a mistress who makes him worse off in body and soul in a state, how can his money to be profitable to him? Obviously. By no means, unless we are ready to maintain that the weed called nightshade, which drives you mad when you eat it, is wealth, which you also can possess, you know. Then money is to be kept at a distance, Critopoulos, if one does not know how to use it, and not to be included in wealth. But how about friends, if one knows how to make use of them, so as to profit by them? What are they to be called? Money by zoo. So, friends can be money. And this is very important for Socrates. In the Apology of Socrates, everyone remembers that scene, Socrates offers a fine, to pay a fine for his alleged crimes, but he ain't got no money. And who will give the money? His friends. A similar scene in the first book of the Republic, where Thrasymachus asks for money. Socrates says, I ain't got no money. Who will pay the money? Again, the friends. Why should it be more decent to be supported by one's friends than by one's students? I mean, you know, of course one could say what kind of friends and what kind of students. That would obviously be the difference. I make this simple inference, that Socrates' rejections of the sophists cannot be identical with the popular rejection of sophists. He must have a somewhat different ground. Now, what is the difference between the philosopher and the sophist from Socrates' point of view? And I think we can say very simply this, provisionally, but not misleadingly. The sophist is a kind of charlatan, prompted by base ambition, very clever, a master of fireworks, but who does what he does because he desires to make a splash. Democritus, the famous atomist, surely very different in his thought from that of Socrates and Plato, said of himself, he came to Athens and no one knew him, no one took any notice of him, and it didn't disturb him particularly. Democritus was not a Socrates. The philosophers are not charlatans. I would say that is an important point to make. And there is a very beautiful illustration of that in that work which comes closer to presenting a philosopher as charlatan than any other I know of, and that is Descartes' Discourse on Method, which is a very indescribably beautiful piece of writing. But the one of its many charms consists precisely that Descartes presents himself here as a man who brings all benefits, like a sophisticated crier on a fair. I can make you immortal with my pills, and I, you know, all kinds of other things. But here it was obviously ironical. In other words, Descartes proves in a way that he is not a charlatan by presenting himself as a charlatan. Yes, and I suppose one can say that in general, that the philosophers are not charlatans. And there are perhaps some borderline cases. One is a very famous contemporary case, which I think we are not sufficiently familiar with one another, so as to use that example maybe later on a proper occasion, I will do it. But to come back for one second to the text, we must not conclude. Socrates debunks, has debunked the sophists. No decent man would wish to become a sophist. He has not debunked, of course, sophistry. On the contrary, boy from a good family wish to become a sport teacher, a gymnastic teacher, a teacher of reading and writing? Of course not. And yet it was perfectly proper for him to go to school with these people. Why should he not go to school with the sophist, just as he went to school with the gymnastic teacher or with the teacher of reading, writing, arithmetic, and never dreaming, of course, that he would exercise later on such a profession, contrary to President Johnson, who does not blush of having been a teacher, a simple teacher. The profession, say, of teaching these simple things may not become a private and free man. The two words are almost identical here. A man who leads a retired life and who is a free man. But the teaching of it may very well be. And therefore, there is no difficulty yet. That only Socrates reminded him of a fact that while he admires Protagoras, he would never wish to be such a man. Just as, say, in the last century, a well-bred girl might admire an actress, or two centuries ago, might admire an actress, and of course never wish to become an actress. That is, I believe, the nearest example I can think of now, from our world. This is clear. And now, but Socrates doesn't leave it at that. He raises now the question, is it as unobjectionable and as simple to go to school with a sophist as it is to go to school with a teacher of the three R's? The answer is no, but we must not conclude.
The need of affection.
Yeah.
Now that is not a blatant contradiction, but it does seem to be a bit inconsistent with this.
All right. How would you translate it into another language so that Rousseau can? I mean, what is the fact which Rousseau has in mind? I mean, which even the social scientists today would admit.
Well, this, he does he just mean that that he wants someone to agree that he is a that he wants people around him to like him, but he doesn't
Look, what would, I mean, in the first place, I think it is true that mothers of children, yeah? Mothers of children, just as mothers of puppies have a natural urge to take care of these helpless creatures, yeah? To give them, suck to them and so on. Yeah? So. And there is obviously some sort of reasonableness in it. Because if, since for one reason or the other, the young ones of various species, including the human species, would perish inevitably if the mother would not take care of them, there is a kind, it looks like a teriology, doesn't it? That nature has so arranged things that the helplessness of the baby corresponds to the concern of the mother, even of the father.
Yes, but Rousseau wants to deny any form of natural sociality. I mean, that market itself doesn't, I mean, it seems perfectly sensible, but I'm trying to reconcile every market in a way that's consistent with his.
Rousseau goes, so far we have seen, man is the least gregarious of all animals, he says. Yeah? We have seen in the last time. Yeah, but still, how could he do it? Hobbes also admits these facts, by the way. But how does he get away with it? These are just, there is in the first place natural lust, as he calls it, yeah, which leads to the procreation of children. And then there is something like it, a mere, a sub-moral urge of the mother, and in a way also of the parents, to take care of the children. This does not in any way lead to anything to be called society. That is developed perhaps with Rousseau at great length in a note to the Second Discourse, which we haven't read. I believe it is not even in the English translation, where he takes issue with Locke. Locke says, Locke gave a construction on Hobbesian lines of the conjugal society, as he calls it. And he says, well, there is nothing particular. You have this also in certain animal species that they remain together to take care of their offspring. In the case of man, this society lasts longer and is firmer than the case of the other species. He never tells you how long and how firm it is. But the notion is, as soon as the children are grown up, there's no longer any need for any relation between the children and the parents, and for the parents among themselves. Do you see? In other words, this, the conjugal society, if we use Lockean phrase, is in no way the seminary of civil society. In no way. Because a civil society is an association of grown-up males.
Yeah, but Locke would say that your obligation, your parental obligations remain.
Yeah, in what sense can you call these obligations? You see, you must read the chapter in Locke, I believe it's chapter 7, I'm not certain. Where he speaks about it and read it with some care. I mean, because the first impression is, of course, this is just, he quotes all the time, honor father and mother, yeah? It sounds simply a reproduction of the biblical teaching, and when you look more closely, that's not true. And, let me see. So, if a grown-up child has any obligation of obedience to his father, yeah? Is due only to the expectation of inheritance. Yeah? He says so. Yeah, very good. Locke says, truly, this is not a natural obligation. But he says it's a very powerful obligation, I'm sure it is.
The Bible is a little hard-boiled in the point, too. One of the honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long in the land.
Yeah, but that is not, still another story. That is not quite the same. That is a... thy days means probably something different. And maybe that the day of the whole nation. You know? Mm-hmm. That's the whole nation, that's the well-being of the whole society. Mm-hmm. That's something slightly different, actually. Good. Yes?
In page 69, give the injunction never hurt anybody. It doesn't seem to be grounded on this contract.
In page 69, where is that? At the top, yeah, that we wanted to read anyway. We will read that, yeah?
The only moral lesson which is suited for a child, the most important lesson...
No, can you begin at the beginning of this paragraph?
Examine your rules of education. You will find them all topsy-turvy, especially in all that concerns virtue and morals. The only moral lesson which is suited for a child, the most important lesson for every time of life, is this. Never hurt anybody. The very rule of well-doing, if not subordinated to this rule, is dangerous, false, and contradictory. Who is there who does no good? Everyone does some good, the wicked as well as the righteous. He makes one happy, cost to the misery of 100, and hence bring all our misfortune.
Who is the one whom he makes happy? Yeah, funny argument, isn't it? Yeah, good.
The noblest virtues are negative. They are also the most difficult, for they make little show, and do not even make room for that pleasure so dear to the heart of man, the thought that someone is pleased with us.
Let us read the note, which is this.
The precept, never hurt anybody, implies the greatest possible independence of human society. For in the social state, one man's good is another man's evil. This relation is part of the nature of things. It is inevitable. You may apply this test to man in society and to the hermit to discover which is best. A distinguished author says, none but the wicked can live alone.
That is Diderot, who said it in application to Rousseau. Yeah. But Rousseau, because Rousseau said this because Rousseau was so unsocial, and he meant that shows the fundamental viciousness of Rousseau. Yes? I say.
Yes. Yeah. None but the good can live alone. This proposition, if less contentious, is truer and more logical than the other. If the wicked were alone, what evil would he do? It is among his fellows that he lays his snares for others. If they wish to apply this argument to the man of property, my answer is to be found in the passage to which this note is appended.
Yeah. Now, let us see. What is it? How would you say that? What is the difficulty?
Well, it seems as though this is not really grounded in contract.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, but what does it mean? What does it mean? How far does it give you guidance? Not to harm anybody, yeah? Not to harm anybody. And then Rousseau says, when you live in society, you necessarily harm somebody. Doesn't that say so? Well, that is what we have seen, his change of the fundamental law regarding the neighbor. Pursue your good with the least evil to someone else. You will harm other people. That goes without saying. But don't harm anyone unnecessarily. This is what it amounts to. Now Rousseau says there is, you remember from the second discourse, this is due to a natural instinct which he calls commiseration or compassion. Yeah? Compassion. And this is later on reinforced by reasoning, or by the very simple reason that if you hurt people unnecessarily, especially, if you hurt them all the time, you will have a very difficult life. So it is most imprudent to harm people unnecessarily. I do not see what's the difficulty. What is the difficulty?
Ultimately, we come back to this famous distinction we had before. Namely, the good man is a solitary. Therefore, he lives as an individual. The individual spends all the time. And here we have the citizens. This formula is absolutely crucial. And now the citizen, of course, is a man who makes a contract. He doesn't have any. The good man has no duty. Because, that's a key distinction for Rousseau. So goodness is not virtue. It's not virtue. And so he has only knowledge. Virtue some is based in one way or the other on the social contract. The whole world of obligations, duties, virtues, morality is unnatural and yet necessary. That's the point. That's to say, the whole world of the conscience is distinguished from simple natural goodness, where conscience doesn't come in, belongs to the world of contract. We must keep this in mind in order to understand the profession of faith and the Savoyard figure. There are three more passages which we should read, and then we must stop. On page 73, in the third paragraph.
If the study of languages were merely the study of words, that is, of the symbols by which language expresses itself, then this might be a suitable study for children. But languages, as they change the symbols, also modify the ideas which the symbols express.
He doesn't say symbols, but signs, which is perhaps better because it is not loaded with these complicated theories of symbols with which we are today bothered. Yeah.
Minds are formed by language. Thoughts take their color from its ideas. Reason alone is common to all. Every language has its own form.
Yeah, I read this only for those of you who have listened to my lecture last Monday. That is an older view. Yeah. The older. The distinction between the language. In page 74, paragraph 4, the beginning is not entirely unamusing. Readers always remember that he who speaks to you is neither a scholar nor a philosopher, but a simple man, lover of truth, without party, without system, and so on. Well, he is not as simple as he says. As a last point, and that is important to keep in mind throughout, on page 76, paragraph 2, towards the end of that paragraph, this we must keep in mind throughout when he says it with the first word. Yeah? Reinforce it strongly, there are many more passages. The key principle, I think, of Rousseau's education is bring up the child without any prejudices, without any trust in other people.